Days before school resumes in Wellesley, 300 people turned out for a vigil yesterday to support a teenager who became the focus of racial attacks on Facebook. The teen and his family say they believe the people of Wellesley support equality. Officials say the attacks appear to have been made by 7 other teenagers, 3 from Wellesley and 4 from nearby communities. WBUR's Fred Tice reports on yesterday's town hall vigil.
Tendai Musikavanu and his family emigrated from South Africa and made their home in Wellesley 7 years ago.
Many of you have heard the racial slurs, degrading invective, and insults our family faced when these 7 young boys spewed rants of prejudice, calling me and my family the N-word, questioning whether we were even human, wanting us to go back to Africa, and stating that our family were taking American jobs and that we'll be lynched or genocided.
As a private equity investor, Musikavanu says he creates jobs in the United States.
This event, occurring in one of the country's most affluent, sophisticated towns, is proof that no one is immune to racism, whether as a victim or a perpetrator.
Musikavanu's 15-year-old son, whom, at the request of his father, WBUR is not naming, also spoke to the crowd.
It's truly an honor to be able to address my town because it means that I have a chance to shed some light on this very dark situation. And it means that I can aid this town through this period of reflection. When someone's family is put to question and they are attacked racially or in any form, it is very difficult to be able to gather your thoughts and emotions. But thankfully, time and God has allowed me to stand before you today.
Musikavanu is back in school on Wednesday, where a school-wide discussion of what happened to him is planned. A tear perched on the edge of his father's eye as he talked about how he felt as he received a standing ovation from the townspeople.
No one likes to see their family attacked.
Asked whether the current political climate in this country encouraged those teenagers to say what they did on Facebook, Musikavanu had this to say.
Whether Trump or whether anybody else, these issues are bubbling beneath the surface. And all that's happening is some people are the pimple through which this pus comes out. The question then is, how do we address the issues, the underlying issues in our country?
Among the nearly 300 people who attended the vigil was Mary Scanlon, whose granddaughter is a student at the high school.
I was surprised by it because I didn't think Wellesley was like that. And I want to do my part to make Wellesley a better place.
Standing next to Scanlon was the father of a student at the high school, Tim Rake.
I'm definitely surprised that people would have done what they did. But I think deep down, we know that racism exists and it's our job to combat it. And that's why it came out, I think.
After the speeches, people lingered for a while talking to one another. The town is planning another event to talk about inclusion next month. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Fred Tice.
A chemical plume from a Dartmouth College hazardous waste site appears to be moving toward a neighborhood in Hanover, New Hampshire. Reporter Rebecca Sinanis has more on how the chemical waste affected groundwater and on a family who says their land is contaminated.
When Debbie Higgins wants a glass of water in her home, she passes her sink and heads to a cooler of water provided by Dartmouth College.
And this is the water we use for brushing our teeth, for drinking, for washing fruits and vegetables, for cooking.
It's been like this since last September, when Dartmouth notified Debbie and her husband, Richard Higgins, that 1,4-dioxane, a probable carcinogen, had contaminated their water. A chemical plume had moved downhill from a burial site about 800 feet away. Richard Higgins hikes up the steep, marshy hill towards Rennie Farm. In the 1960s and 70s, it was a burial ground for lab animals, human tissue, fetuses, and radioactive materials used for research. This, according to Dartmouth Medical School records. The plot is about half an acre. Dartmouth tried to sell the property in 2011 and planned to clean up the site. The company hired by Dartmouth to excavate Rennie Farm reported finding rusted cans filled with deep purple chemical liquid, smelling of solvents, leaked into the ground, discoloring the soil. The digging also revealed animal carcasses were buried deeper than records showed and in layers throughout the site. Further sampling found 1,4-dioxane and a handful of radionuclides had seeped into the groundwater.
This is the hillside of drilled sampling wells.
Dartmouth set up test wells on their property to see if the contamination had moved. It had. The New Hampshire state limit for 1,4-dioxane in drinking water is 3 parts per billion. Richard Higgins points out one of the wells, about a football field away from his property.
In July of 2015, Dartmouth had a reading in this well at 520 parts per billion.
That's hundreds of times the state limit. 2 months later, Dartmouth told the Higgins to stop drinking the water. But Debbie Higgins had already experienced unexplainable symptoms.
I was having some vertigo. It felt like water was in my left ear constantly. And every time I tipped my head up, I would get dizzy. So when I went for my yearly exam, I mentioned that to my doctor and she looked at my ear like there's nothing clogging it up. She sees nothing in there. When we started drinking the bottled water, within 2 weeks, I had absolutely no symptoms whatsoever. And I haven't had any since.
Both Debbie and Richard Higgins report other short-term health problems. Hair loss, skin peeling in their mouths, open sores between their fingers. Their dog was urinating blood. It all stopped when the bottled water came. But the Higgins call themselves the human guinea pigs on the possible long-term health effects of 1,4-dioxane.
We're worried that there is going to be long-term health effects because we had short-term health effects. So, yeah, it worries us a lot, you know, and there's not a lot that we can do about it.
The Higgins have tried to relocate, but realtors say contaminated land in Hanover is unsaleable. To complicate matters, Debbie Higgins is wheelchair-bound and needs to live in a handicap-accessible home. At her office, several miles away, Ellen Arnold is the director of real estate at Dartmouth College. She's been involved in the Rennie Farm case for several years and says selling contaminated property has not been difficult in her experience.
Simply being adjacent to or even having contamination on your property, it will have an impact on value, but those properties are used all the time and are sold all the time. But we are doing everything we can to make sure that the contamination stays on our property and shouldn't impact anyone else's.
Dartmouth has been in ongoing mediation with the Higgins. Arnold declined to comment on the Higgins case specifically. The college has already invested $5 million into the site cleanup. Arnold says Dartmouth has the same goal as those living near the burial site.
Our concerns are exactly the same as those of the neighbors, and our goal is exactly the same as theirs, to make sure that this site is clean and doesn't present a safety risk.
Now, separately from the Higgins, other area residents are asking Dartmouth to do more. New test wells are being set up past the Higgins house in the direction that the plume is likely heading. It is still unknown if other neighbors in the area are drinking the probable carcinogen. I'm Rebecca Sinanis in Norwich.
What is the best public art in Boston? That's a subjective question, to be sure, but we've decided to compile a list. This comprehensive list is being published today on The Artery. It's the brainchild of Artery reporter Greg Cook, who spent a long time thinking about public art and putting them in his own order. And Greg joins us now to talk about his decision-making process as well as some of the pieces of public art. Hello, Greg.
Hello.
Why do you think that now is the time to look at permanent public art in Boston?
We've seen in Boston this really exciting explosion of temporary public art. Things like the big mural on the side of the Hancock Building by the French artist J.R. and the Brooklyn artist Janet Eichelman's glowing web over the Greenway. And so I kept thinking about there's this feeling of excitement around these things and possibility. There's a lot of criticism often of public art in this town that it's too, like it's all dead white guys in bronze sort of in squares of downtown. The list is built to look at things that often aren't included in the list of public art and to represent people in our community who often then get left out because of the narrowness of those definitions. I purposely put a list together that's ranked so that people would debate me and argue with me and send their own suggestions. We need to have a discussion about what we value in public art in this town.
How did you decide what pieces you were going to put on this list?
A lot of walking around. But I think, I mean, my criteria is things like, how does it look? What does it say about our neighborhoods, their diversity, their history? Does the piece make the place it's at better, more interesting, more meaningful?
Let's talk about some of the things on the list and whether there are any themes, because it looks like we've got some landmarks here. You've got the orange dinosaur on Route 1 in Saugus, the Hood milk bottle at the Children's Museum, and then the Sitco sign. So what do you think that these things sort of symbolize?
I mean, I think one thing is that if you make such a great piece of public art that it becomes a landmark, that's really a sign of success, right? Mm-hmm. A number of these that you mentioned are commercial pieces that somehow really connect with us. And I think these commercial pieces have a way of being fun and attractive and playful. And then the Sitco sign is a really interesting one. There's been a couple efforts to preserve it as a historical landmark when people were trying to tear it down. And I think that's where it's become something else, not just a commercial billboard, but something that we as a community have decided that it's really important for us.
One of your surprising selections was the Lewis D. Brown Institute Memorial buttons. Now, those are round pins that people can wear on their backpacks or clothes or wherever. Can you describe what they're memorializing? And what about them made you choose them to put on your list?
The buttons, to me, are one of the most moving pieces of public art in the city. And what they are is they're memorials to people in Boston who've been killed primarily in gun violence and gang violence in the city. And they're striking how young the people are who have been dying and the sort of cost to the city. And then the people who survive, like their loved ones who wear these buttons, many of them are, you know, students in our city. And when you think about it, it makes it so visible, the hurt to people in our community. They go back to Tina Sherry, whose son was killed as a bystander in a gang shootout back in 1993. Part of her healing was she started making buttons for other people who lost their children to this violence.
There's a lot of history on your list, because number one on the list is the Robert Gould Shaw Memorial on the Boston Common, and that commemorates the all-black 54th Regiment in the Civil War and their white commander who unsuccessfully stormed Fort Wagner in Charleston, South Carolina. We actually have a cut here from documentarian Ken Burns describing the monument to school children. Let's listen.
Many of the soldiers were killed, including Colonel Shaw, and his body was thrown in with the African Americans because the Southerners, who were hoping to perpetuate slavery, thought that that would be a terrible way to die. His father, when he heard the news, said he was honored that his son would be buried that way.
Greg Cook, why is this number one on your list of public art in Boston?
It's an incredibly beautiful piece, and it's often considered one of the greatest 19th century sculptures in whole country. But it's also really interesting about what it says about Boston. Think about where it's placed. It's placed in this incredibly visible and important location. It's right on the Common, and it's right at the State House. It's a symbol of Boston's commitment to equality. Boston had been the capital of abolition in the country, and sort of that led to the Civil War. And here they are saying 30 years later, we are still so deeply committed to this cause of equality in our country that we are going to put it in this such a prominent location.
That's The Arteries, Greg Cook. You can go online and find this special project. We have photos and descriptions of all 50 works and an interactive map to find them. Also, let us know your favorites. What did Greg miss or get wrong? You can contact us at The Artery or on Facebook or Twitter at WBUR Artery. Greg, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.